call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Clerk will take the roll. I believe we do have a quorum present, so we're officially convened. Representative Bly moves approval of the minutes from January 29th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Two items on the agenda today, members. The first is one of the items of business that we were not able to get to at the last meeting, which is kind of to wrap up the testimony that we had on the Minnesota transmission system, which is obviously something that is totally relevant to the second item on the agenda for today, which is Representative Peterson's House File Number 4. So if we could, Mr. Grove, if you could come forward and tell us what you want us to know about the CapEx view of our current transmission status, we appreciate that. And please identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Terry Grove, representing the CapEx utilities. Thank you, Chairman Helty and members of the committee, for giving me a little time to complete my testimony. I understand your time constraints, and we'll try to be very brief. I will hit just a few points from a handout you should have in your packet. This is updated, dated January 31st on the initial slide. I'll make my comments very brief on most of it. The issues were well covered by Mr. Mulver of the Midwest ISO and Ms. Soholt of Wind on the Wires. Turning to slide two, just to provide some perspective, there's been great progress made on transmission in southwest Minnesota through some projects Xcel Energy has done down there, Southwest Minnesota Project and Buffalo Ridge Incremental Generation Project. And the upshot of those will be that in 2007, Xcel alone expects to be at approximately 1,300 megawatts of wind generation there. That obviously doesn't include things other utilities have done or developments in other areas. That does help put in perspective later, though, of how far transmission outlet for renewables needs to go to meet a higher renewable portfolio standard. Turning to slide three, last time I touched on the CapEx proposals, and they're to build the projects that are needed for reliability, that are fundamental to a variety of generation scenarios, and contribute up to 1,000 megawatts or more of transmission for renewables. Skipping ahead to slide six, which is the top of page four, I think the question then is, where does that leave us? As a bogey, if you said that there was a 25% renewable standard by perhaps 2020, that would say that approximately 5,700 megawatts more of generation are needed. That's the number Mr. Mulver had also thrown out. The portion that Xcel will have that will count towards a renewable and have transmission outlet in 2010 is about 700 megawatts. Looking at the 1,000 megawatts that the CapEx projects will provide when they're completed, that's on the order of 4,000 megawatts more of wind resources and transmission capability to serve them, regardless of which utility does them, whether they're small-scale, distributed, seabed-type resources or more concentrated resources. 4,000 megawatts, in our estimations, the CapEx utilities is a tall order to get outlet for. Turning to the next slide, slide seven, we are committed to planning the facilities that will be required to do that. We've had some very good discussions with stakeholder groups recently and think that we have an idea of the most efficient way that we could plan the post-Group 1 projects. taking into account all the uncertainties that Mr. Moeller mentioned and are very relevant, what are other states doing, what is the region doing, we would look on an expedited basis to work with the Midwest ISO stakeholders, other participants like the agencies, to find projects that have characteristics similar to the Group 1 projects. That is, they're needed for a variety of scenarios, they perform well, and we could embark on a plan to immediately take those from the results of the technical studies through the subsequent more detailed engineering-oriented studies to eventually the permitting process. That said, turning to slide 8, given the amount of outlet capability for renewables that would be required for, say, up to 4,000 megawatts, we do have some concerns that we don't want anyone to draw the impression this is a slam dunk to get there on transmission. Mr. Moeller did an excellent job of describing why the transmission needs to fit in regionally and perhaps even nationally. There is a huge opportunity, we feel, for Minnesota if we design the right kind of transmission outlet, especially in the later stages, to make Minnesota and the surrounding region suppliers to other regions that aren't fortunate enough to have wind resource. But while those policy decisions setting out, we're planning against a background of uncertainty, and we want to make sure we plan well. I'd mentioned last time it's just a lot of construction. It's going to tax the ability to integrate it with other construction. For instance, we take over corridors from existing lines and have to figure out how to do that. It is simply a large construction effort and a large workforce to do it. The projects that will enable up to, say, 4,000 megawatts will not simply be in Minnesota. There'll be projects built in other areas by other parties. Everything has to dovetail. The permitting, including in other states and at the federal level, it takes time, and it's very complex as we start trying to dovetail other permitting processes. As we get farther into this, legislators and a lot of other people are going to hear about the perceived impacts as we start multiple simultaneous routing processes in a lot of the state. And finally, among the others that will be working very hard, is going to impose quite a burden on the agency staff, the Department of Commerce, and Public Utilities Commission as we bring in very complex projects to be permitted. That is an overview of how we view transmission. I want to make just a few comments that are, I think, are responsive to the questions that were asked last time on distributed seabed type generation and the comments that were made about them. Turning to slide 9, I'd just like to say I agree with many of the characterizations that Mr. Machado and Mr. Jewell made about the very sensible reasons why distributed resources should be added and why they make sense. Adding them, appropriate amounts of distributed resource in the right areas is truly an opportunity. They describe that very well, that you utilize the existing infrastructure to the maximum amount possible, you distribute the wind and hence make it less volatile, and you distribute the benefits of having wind generation. That said, there are some issues to consider. I believe it was Mr. Machado who termed it, you're connecting to the on-ramp to the freeway. Well, even the on-ramp, or issues in vicinity of the on-ramp need to be considered. You need to look at whether it's going to cause power quality problems for those that live in the area. For instance, it can literally flicker their lights. Is it going to overload facilities in that area? As they pointed out, you need to make sure it interfaces to the controls that protect the power system. In the scheme of things, those are relatively small, fixable problems. There's not a cookbook fix. It's going to vary by situation, but they are fixes that can be implemented in the local area where the distributed generation is added. As Mr. Moeller observed, though, the generation also needs to get to market for a couple reasons. If you take an area where you have good wind on any given day and moderate temperatures that translate into low customer load, the power is going to have to be exported someplace else. to some degree. Mr. Moeller also did an excellent job of describing why you need the shock absorber of the Midwest ISO energy market and balancing market to, in total, deal with the variability of wind. Well, the promise of the small distributed generation projects, the ideal scenario is you find a local area where those issues I mentioned are manageable, they can be solved easily, and there is some excess transmission capacity to get the energy to the market. That is truly a winning situation. We have embarked on studies with stakeholder groups, including advocates for distributed generation. I believe those studies, in my opinion, have been sort of a journey of all of us learning together. But we need to keep looking at these for these sweet spots where distributed generation can truly realize its promise and help meet the renewables portfolio standard. Turning to the next slide, though, there are situations with distributed generation that are more complicated. If you had an area that, say, has little distributed generation and you added a lot of distributed generation, you're going to outstrip the customer load in that area, and you're very much going to need a transmission system capable of integrating it in the market. The other sort of analogous situation is at southwestern Minnesota. You have a low load area that's now very rich in generation. You have some transmission into the area, but the transmission is already at its limit. It's constrained. For adding distributed generation in either of those situations still requires transmission. We get back to the same place again, and as the CapEx utilities, if those are decisions that by developers, utilities, policy decisions, we want to add that transmission, but distributed generation in those situations is not a panacea. It doesn't save transmission. It can actually drive the construction of new transmission. Finally, I'll restate our commitment as the CapEx utilities to work with all parties. We believe we've advanced plans in several areas. The Group 1 effort, our work with distributed generation, we're out to continue that work with all stakeholders. We have the skeleton of a very expeditious plan find the transmission that's needed for meeting the renewable portfolio standard. With that, I'll answer any questions if I can.
Members have any questions at this time? Thank you very much, Mr. Grove. I appreciate your testimony. I'm sorry that we had to make you come back to finish up, but I'm sure we'll be relying on your expertise as we pursue this process.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to House File 4.
Representative, I think the motion would be to House File 4 recommended to pass
and
refer to the
General Register.
Very good, Mr. Peterson. We have your bill before us. Would you like to walk us through it?
Yes, and with the realization that some people are in from out of town, I'll go quickly, and I believe we have testimony to fill up a couple committee hearings so we can get to guts, details, and maybe more in-depth member probing, if you will, after the people from out of town have had their opportunity. So I'm using Mr. Eliff's bill summary that's in the packet. House File 4 amends the renewable energy objective in Minnesota, sets a target for each utility regarding the proportion of electric generation based on renewable resources, which wind, hydroelectric under 100 megawatts, biomass, solar, and then there's some descriptions of what counts, mixed municipal solid waste, refuse-derived fuel from mixed municipal solid waste as the primary fuel. And that's the definition that, that's been under the REO for a little while now. And the next part, the next change, maybe we'll spend a lot of time, is it accelerates the transition from the current 10% by 2015 to 11% in 2013, 15% in 2015, 25% in 2020. And it would be a requirement, and the bill and the amounts become mandatory after beginning in 2013. So it's 2007 right now. So between now and 2013, and then after 2013, there's a couple of phases of this proposal. And in the last section of the bill, which for those who have been watching for a number of years, this part has not been in before, but has been put in now, and that is a compliance and financial penalties on utilities that fail to comply or achieve compliance, which before Christmas, Governor Puente suggested that as a mechanism, and that has been added to the bill in this iteration of it, I guess, as it stands today. Now, we have a renewable energy objective. 22 states plus the District of Columbia have renewable energy standards, renewable portfolio standards, whatever you would like to call them. But next to Minnesota's, if you look, there's always a little asterisk or check or something that requires you to go into, if you're looking at Minnesota, to describe our REO versus the renewable energy standard as it, you could say, applies since 1994 to Xcel Energy, but not to some of the other utilities involved with retail electric sales in the state of Minnesota. This bill would put that away, if you will, and make it such that we would have a renewable energy standard as understood by the marketplace in this sector of the economy. Now, just briefly, some will talk about cost, and the difficulty with complying with a standard on cost. I think the analysis that has been done, that there are several parts of the with renewable energy technology, and just provincially in my part of the state, it's been primarily wind. And I think that analysis in the fall was done that the driving component of price is the exchange rate with the euro. And I know from experience, a person in my area who is invested in a turbine, the amount of his loan is significantly higher because some of the parts needed for the turbine are manufactured in Europe, and therefore the loan has to be done with the exchange rate built into the debt servicing on that machine, if you will. So there's one thing right there is the currency. Others will say that it's maybe too much, too soon, too fast, given a 2.49% load growth per year. But I also know that this committee will be looking at or talking about, and the governor has proposed efficiency and conservation measures. So as we go through, what is the load growth per year as it might be changed under laws that yet may be adopted in the state this year potentially? And the governor has recommendations and others have ideas as we go through. Discussion on transmission. Is it $5 billion, $4 billion, $3 billion? And is it not? Is there transmission available without construction of large overhead distant hard to site transmission lines? We've seen and heard testimony on both sides of that debate. And what I think though And talking with folks who are on either side of this issue, either advocates for or those who have concerns, is that a renewable energy standard is a tool and a piece of the larger discussion on the next generation of energy in the United States. And what I think is the case, if you read tea leaves or whatever your preferred method of predicting the future is, or what your faith in life is that I think a renewable energy standard that's aggressive relative to other states but is not out of line with what other states have proposed, and we can get into some of that later as to what other states have done, is that I think the larger, maybe bigger part of this is what to do about climate change and global warming and how that's going to affect Minnesota, being at the triple junction of the tallgrass prairie, the hardwood forest, and the boreal forest, where the calculus says that you're going to see the most changes at those thresholds in the upper Midwest. And we have the responsibility, I believe, to my generation and those to follow to take aggressive positions on technologies that are doable, that have been done, and can be, I believe, done aggressively and prudently without disrupting the market, which you could say might not be a market because I don't have a choice as to who sends me my energy bill every month. I get the one bill in the mailbox every month. Therefore, I think that an energy standard is an appropriate government intervention, philosophically speaking. Now, the carbon reduction could be the larger problem. Maybe not the energy or electricity standard, but if there's a carbon reduction initiative either at the state level or at the federal level that might be coming, what if it's more cap and less trade? What if it's more trade and not as much cap? You know, what's it going to be? I think a renewable electricity standard and investment in renewable electricity helps meet what might be coming down the road, and I think we have time and interest in satisfying and being prepared for what might be coming later. Now, I think that what has been said in other committees and other venues where we go as bipartisan legislators and we go over to the Humphrey Institute and we hear about the demographic changing in Minnesota and the retirement of the baby boomers and such and the need to fill in the graying industries and the professionals that are in there currently. I am confident that the younger generation can do this and wants to do this. And I think here today and in the next couple hearings, we will have wide-ranging opinions on how it should or should not be done. And with that, I will let us get to testimony, but I'll remind the members what Willard Munger used to say. It's a good bill. Vote for it.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, on page 4, subdivision 5, I have a question. This technology that's based on fuel combustion, would that include coal gasification, specifically the Excelsior Energy Mesaba project, wherever it's going to be located on the Iron Range?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoppe, I believe the definitions are in the front page.
They are. I'm wondering if it includes that specific project or any coal gasification project.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I believe not.
Thank you. Can I ask one other question?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, on page 2, going down line 2.34, when we're talking about the commission must delay or modify the standard for an electric utility. On page 2.34, when it says produce undesirable impacts on the utility's ratepayers, would that include higher rates?
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, the assumption is the higher rates. I believe that assumption on higher rates to be wrong.
Representative Hopping.
Mr. Chair, where does that, and Representative Peterson, I guess I'm confused, where does that leave us?
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Hopping, that leaves us with it in the bill as it stands today. And, you know, undesirable rates at the Public Utility Commission to be decided upon. If it's undesirable impacts, you know, it's in there. If you know, if it goes up, I don't know the percentage that it would have to go up, if it's significant or not. I believe we heard Mr. Wolf earlier this year when the analysis on his electricity bill at his house. And I would be of the variety that said that would not be unreasonable.
Representative Fossey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last thing, I think we all need to keep in mind that while this might be all well and good, we need to make sure that we're keeping the ratepayers in mind. And when I open up my bill, if the rate goes up and I'm paying more, to me that's undesirable.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, I believe there's, I don't have it in front of me, so maybe I shouldn't bring it up, but I believe that they found in Colorado with those who signed up for green power, if you will, versus those who didn't. I believe it might have been the fall or summer of 2005 that comparing the bills for the monthly payment, the ones who had the green power had a lower bill. But I need to look through my files to find that, so take it for what it's worth. But
and Representative Poppy, I'm sure we'll hear some more opinions about this in the next day or two.
I just like to bring things up.
So, we do have a number of testifiers. We're clearly not going to get to all of them today. We ask those testifiers on the list to try to keep their comments as brief as possible, but at the same time, we don't want to leave any messages unheard. And we will make every effort to accommodate people who have traveled a long way to come and testify today. However, our first testifier has probably not come a long way. Mr. Noble from Clean Energy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Noble. I'm the executive director of Fresh Energy. And you're right, I walked from my office downtown. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Coalition of Clean Energy Minnesota. And the members of the steering committee of Clean Energy Minnesota include groups like Windustry, Wind on the Wires, Union of Concerned Scientists, Sierra Club, Minnesota Project, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Minnesota Center for Energy Environment, the Isaac Walton League, our group Fresh Energy, Clean Up Our River Environment, and Clean Water Action. I'm also testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, an 80-member organization representing nearly 500,000 Minnesotans. 41 of the 80-member organizations have adopted the policy platform on clean energy, and I am the immediate past board chair of Minnesota Environmental Partnership. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the renewable energy standard is an idea whose time has come. The state legislatures of 21 states have passed renewable energy standards, as have several countries and Canadian provinces. The idea is a simple idea. It's a market-based policy that creates competition among renewable energy generators, providing the greatest amount of clean energy power for a low cost, creating ongoing incentive to bring costs down. It's a steady, predictable, long-term clean energy market. It supports supported by a clean electricity standard and attracts developers, both community-based developers and national developers, to obtain low-cost financing, achieve economies of scale and production, making renewable energy ever more competitive. Nearly half of all the wind power or all the renewable energy installed in America has been driven by state-based renewable energy standards, according to the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. That includes some 40,000 megawatts of renewable capacity in the U.S. By the year 2020, which is enough to provide electricity to some 25 million homes. The Renewable Energy Standard and Representative Peterson's bill would provide for approximately, if all of the renewable energy were met by wind, but as Representative Peterson said, it's numerous technologies which are able to be meet the standard. It would provide nearly 6,000 megawatts of wind power, which is enough to provide electricity to an average of 2.5 million houses, actually an average of 3.5 million houses, typical houses, and would reduce the global warming pollution equal to taking 2,270,000 cars off the road. So this is not a small idea. This is a significant idea for the environment. The most successful renewable energy standard in the country was signed into law by then-Governor George Bush in Texas in 1999. In 2001, more wind power was installed in Texas than had been installed in the entire country in any prior year. Texas set a 2,000-megawatt goal for renewable energy by the year 2009, and it surpassed that goal 3 years ahead of schedule. Now, California has been surpassed as the wind power capital of the world, and Texas is the wind power capital of America. In August 2005, the legislature in Texas increased the renewable energy standard to about 5,000 megawatts, and they're well on their way to meet that. By our estimates, Minnesota has moved over the last several years from the very top of the renewable energy charts to the middle of the pack over the past few years, but adopting Representative Peterson's bill of 25% by 2020 would allow Minnesota to regain its position of national leadership. Governor Pawlenty has supported, including penalties for noncompliance, when he announced his clean energy initiative in December. There's a lot of evidence suggests that the Minnesota Renewable Energy Objective in state law is not providing the market the kind of assurance that it needs to attract the kind of investment that might be possible. An example that's often cited is a Spanish company, Gamesa, was looking for its U.S. headquarters and spent considerable time looking at Minnesota's Iron Range as a place for building its North American headquarters and production facilities. And in 2004, they decided to locate their business in Pennsylvania, created 1,000 new jobs, $40 million worth of investment over 5 years, and the CEO of Gamesa credits the Pennsylvania Renewable Energy Standard as the primary reason why they chose to locate their manufacturing plant there. We're going to hear a lot about the need for flexibility. You'll hear a lot of testimony about how important it is that the standard be flexible and not rigid. The primary policy tool for flexibility is the buying and selling of renewable energy credits. When I say it's a market-based standard, what we're creating here is a renewable energy market, both for the developers to compete, and then the utilities can buy and sell renewable energy credits to each other for compliance. So it's not that every utility has to have that amount of renewable energy. They can buy these renewable energy credits in order to comply. That's the main flexibility compliance in the bill. And with that, I'd like to summarize by saying a study by the Union of Concerned Scientists last year looked at a federal or national renewable energy standard of about 20% by 2020. And in that study, they estimated that Minnesota would develop roughly 5,000 megawatts of renewable energy. And as I mentioned, this bill has us developing roughly 6,000 megawatts of renewable energy. So that national study is a pretty good proxy for the policy that we're talking about here today. And in their study, they found that a 20% national standard or 5,000 megawatts of new renewable energy in Minnesota would create over 5,000 new permanent jobs in manufacturing, construction, operation, maintenance, and would save consumers over $500 million in lowered electricity and natural gas bills. The primary reason that a renewable energy standard lowers energy costs is because it takes pressure off the natural gas markets that are the resource at the margin for generating electricity. By taking pressure off those natural gas markets, it drives down energy bills modestly. We're not telling you this is a huge windfall, but it's a modest reduction in overall net energy costs to consumers, according to the best analysis that we have available. And with that, I would like to say, and the final point, that the polling that was done in 2005, it shows that between 78 and 87% of Minnesotans strongly support renewable energy standard. I'm saying two different polls. because they embrace this idea of clean, renewable electricity. They embrace the idea of the economic opportunities and the rural development potential of this policy, and they are and certainly enthusiastic about the environmental benefits afforded by renewable energy. With that, Mr. Chair, I close my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. Questions, Representative Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, Mr. Noble, the poll you cite doesn't match what's happening, at least from different co-ops and utilities telling me, and I'm just wondering how would you explain the difference or how do you square this issue? They say the voluntary sign up, the people can subscribe for X amount of megawatts of renewable energy or green energy is often less than 10% and sometimes just a small fraction of their of a take, and yet the public's in polls saying 70-80% want it.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think the polls show that and the market decisions people are making are different? What do you think is leading to that?
That is a very good question. The figures you cite are correct. There have been dozens of polls, literally dozens of polls. The poll that I referenced was a poll that that we commissioned along with United Steelworkers, and we took the poll in 12 legislative districts that were, their index was evenly balanced between the two major parties. So we didn't take the poll in, we took it in southern Minnesota and the northern suburbs and along the I-90 corridor, select, I think, 12 legislative districts. And we had an independent pollster, and we came back with those results of 80% support and some 65% strong support. What you're talking about is the so-called green pricing program, where utilities send a flyer or an announcement to consumers and ask them to sign up for a renewable energy at a price premium. And our staff has also done research on those green pricing programs all over the country, and the typical response to those kinds of proposals is in the 1-2% range. I think the highest quality green pricing program is offered by the city of Moorhead, where approximately 7% of the public has subscribed to buy green energy at a price premium. But these are really two different policy questions. One is how many people, when sent a flyer from the utility, will write a check for more than their electric bill. That's one question, and the answer to that appears to be 1-2%. And the other question is, do you support requiring electric utilities to have a fixed percentage of renewable energy in their portfolio? And the answer is 80-90%. So they're really two different questions.
So,
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, just an observation and then another question. And that's what I am. I was a little perplexed that we as consumers, if we just easily answer questions in the ideal, but then when our pocketbook has to start putting our money where our mouth is, we change our tune, or is it? I hear what you're saying. I think it is two good questions. Sometimes I wonder if how the question was asked would be present different outcomes. But it is something I've always been puzzled with because it doesn't seem like it's been a high subscription. Next question: just the rural development you talked about. Can you tell me specifically what in this bill would help ensure development being owned by local entrepreneurs and within the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Noble?
Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative Westrum, this work of local ownership, no one has pursued this more aggressively or more passionately than the Minnesota State Legislature under leadership of either or both parties. And my presumption is that that will continue to be a very, very high priority for the Minnesota Legislature, provide incentives for local participation and local ownership. In 1995, the very first local ownership bill was heard in this committee room to provide a financial incentive to farmer and rural cooperative and limited liability corporations to come together and own wind power. And when you were committee chair, we all worked together to pass a community-based energy development bill to provide innovative tariffs. And Minnesota is looked to all over the country for its leadership on community ownership and community participation. All the participants in this process, including the clearest and strongest voices for community ownership, have talked about additional work this session to significantly look at our community-based energy development legislation and look at our incentives and look at how it's working and figure out how to expand the equity participation and the entrepreneurship possibilities for rural communities and rural ownership. So I think that is everyone's full intent.
And Representative Westrom, I think that you're pointing out that there isn't any specific language in this bill dealing with community ownership that you would perhaps like to see. That is, I think what this bill is intended to do primarily is to set the context in which community-based ownership is feasible. And as you, I'm sure, are aware, that is an element in House File 436 and in other bills that we'll be considering in this committee. And I can assure you that I think certainly the majority, if not unanimity of this committee is committed to doing as much community-based development as we can.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Nobles, so then, and I heard you say it, right now there's nothing in this bill that assures that, but there may be a bill later if we don't do it in this bill. Or can we look at doing it in this bill, Mr. Chair?
Well, we can look at whatever we want to, but if we don't do it in this bill, Representative Western, I assure you there will be other opportunities.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was interested in some of the statements Mr. Noble made today, especially with the documents we had earlier. I can't find them right now, but I think, Mr. Noble, you suggested that Minnesota was the national leader in years past, and we slipped, I think, in near words to the middle of the pack. I didn't see that in the information we've gotten so far. Where do we rank now in this? I mean, what's the middle of the pack? It looked to me like we were like number three in wind.
I think we're
Mr. Noble.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, I think the total wind energy installation where we are now is number four. But when I referenced middle of the pack, I was talking about the total policy commitment for the size of the market we would eventually have. We're closer to the middle of the pack of the states that have adopted standards.
Okay, because that's the information we had,
Chairman,
earlier. It looked like we were number four, and mm-hmm. you know, we're the leader in ethanol by far, 20%, 10%, first one to do that, and the first one to put in 20%, first one to do a biodiesel mandate at 2%, so I couldn't figure out where the middle of the pack came from, Mr. Noble. But I understand now what, a little bit of what you're talking about, because I'm interested in the facts, that we put out the true facts, and we don't put out sound bites that sound good, and we don't put out fairy tales. We put out the facts here, because this is serious business. And so I want to make it known. I mean, I want to be known as the leading state, and I think we are. And to put us in the middle of the pack, I don't think is right. But my next question, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned the Spanish firm Gamesa, and I think you said that they didn't locate in the Iron Range. They were looking at locating in the Iron Range, and instead went to Pennsylvania because of the standards they enacted. And I don't know what those standards are compared to Minnesota. Maybe you could talk about that. But they put 1,000 jobs in. They were looking, the firm Gamesa was also looking in southwest Minnesota, Mr. Noble, and I didn't hear any discussion from them about the reason they didn't locate in southwest Minnesota was because of a lack of a standard. But I do know that the firm... Suslan came in from India. We actually insourced a company to build wind turbines from India. And they're at about 275 jobs now, only making the blades and the nose cones with the ancillary jobs. I estimate that to be close to 400 jobs in southwest Minnesota. And I know the discussions they had with them, certainly the work that Representative Westrom led and others participated in. Others in the room, frankly, talking about seabed legislation certainly was one of the keys. I didn't I don't recall any discussions I've ever had with Suslan, and I had many of them over the last year and a half or so, starting when they looked at coming in here about them moving to Minnesota because we haven't had a renewable standard. So I guess I'm concerned about, is it a fact that Gamesa did not locate in Minnesota because of this and located in Pennsylvania instead?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Noel?
Mr. Chair, first of all, on the middle of the pack comment, I certainly concur with all your points about Minnesota's leadership on numerous renewable energy initiatives, ethanol, biodiesel. I salute your work and others' work in that area. The specific policy statement I made was that on renewable electricity requirements by law, that of the 20 states that have those requirements, our total requirement is in the middle of the pack.
21.
I have 21 states that have requirements, and I have to tell you, I don't know whether we're number 7 or number 9 or number 11, but I know we're not in the top 5 of the total requirements we have in law. And related to the question about Gamesa and Suslan, you know, I didn't represent that was the reason for their decision. I represented that was what their CEO said, that Pennsylvania's renewable energy standard, I think my quote was one of the main reasons why they chose to locate their manufacturing in Pennsylvania. So obviously business location has many, many factors, access to market, quality of roads, availability of incentives. There are many, many, many factors. But the CEO of Gamesa said it was one of the main reasons they chose to locate in Pennsylvania was the access to the market that was the renewable energy standard provided. And the last point related to Suslan is there is a letter on record of approximately 2 years old that the Suslan CEO has recommended passage of a Minnesota renewable energy standard.
And they're in Pipestone today, Mr. Chairman?
Pipestone, Minnesota, mm-hmm. World headquarters, or U.S. North American headquarters for a company from South Asia, India.
Thanks.
Pretty exciting, isn't it?
Fun.
I like it a lot. I like it a lot, too, Representative Magnus.
If there are no more questions for Mr. Noble, we do have a full agenda, so perhaps we could move to Mr. Dunlop from the American Wind Energy Association.
Mr. Dunlop, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chairman Hilty. Chairman Hilty, members of the committee, my name is John Dunlop. I am from Minnesota. However, I work for the American Wind Energy Association, which is a trade association for the wind power industry in the United States. Others who will be testifying today are a few of our members, but we do represent the vast majority of people who are involved in the wind energy industry. I'd like to address very directly the impact of a renewable electricity standard on costs. I certainly am in favor of the bill, and I believe that you're receiving a handout which gives an indication that indeed last year was a very good year for wind industry in this country. Total capacity of wind energy installations in this country increased by 27% last year. That represents an investment of over $4 billion. Even I'm getting used to saying the word billion. It's rather uncomfortable because the industry is growing. Minnesota, as it says in there, was one of the five top states in new installations last year. And as Mr. Noble just pointed out, that Minnesota is number 4 in terms of the total installed capacity in this country. In contrast to that, however, Minnesota is number 9, ranks number 9 in the nation in terms of wind energy capacity. And that capacity, actually, using today's technology, could produce enough electricity to produce 10 times as much electricity as we currently use in the state. So the wind energy potential in the state is not in question. On the back of that handout, you'll see another graph that I added to the bottom of the page. And that indicates that the market that we have seen over the past decade for wind energy in this country. And any of you business people will certainly recognize that would be a very difficult market to match, where you see a 5-fold increase in sales from 1 year to the next. That is a direct function of the erratic federal policy on renewable energy, wind energy in particular. the I'm sure many of you are aware of the nature of the law. It was passed back in 1992, but it actually provides an investment tax credit for the production of electricity from wind energy, and quite frankly, it's a very attractive law. It works from a public policy standpoint very well because it incents the proper behavior. You only receive a tax credit if your product is a good product, it's sited properly, it's operated properly, and it runs well for 10 years. In fact, it is such a popular public policy instrument that whenever it is up for renewal, it gets hung full of things that are not as attractive because it's going to fly through. Consequently, in many cases, the law has been allowed to expire before it was renewed, and consequently, that's why some of those years are so low. It's very hard to build a business around that sort of an erratic market. Many of the states, of the 21 states that Mr. Noble mentioned, have taken matters into their own hands, basically, that they are establishing a long-term steady market for wind energy in particular and for renewables in general. That steady market does invite additional companies to locate in the areas where those markets have been located. And you already mentioned that the Gamesa situation is certainly, I think, well known within the industry that a major reason why the Gamesa did go to Pennsylvania is because of the long-term stable policy that was established in that state. Now, I've heard the concern that if you pass a standard, that allows the price to escalate. Our experience is exactly the opposite of that. If you establish a standard, it really invites competition, and that competition tends to keep the prices down. In fact, one of our major members estimated that the cost of providing electricity in this market, with that kind of an erratic market, is up to 20% higher than it would be if they could have a steady business to supply electricity. So consequently, the states are providing that opportunity to create a long-term market that's predictable for 20 years or more, and therefore it invites more competition. And as we talked about this morning, a way of providing lower cost of energy is to locate the manufacturing facilities in the region where the market is growing. And we've seen that happen, and we've already cited the situation with Suzlon in southwestern Minnesota. They did note that Minnesota has had positive public policies in the state for the last 15 years supporting renewable energy. Then that did help them make that decision to sell the first turbines that were ever sold in America from Suzlon in Minnesota, and their first manufacturing facility in the state as well. The cost is lower. We mentioned, I think Mr. Noble again mentioned the situation in Colorado where they have a statewide standard. A study was done last summer, and Colorado consumers Colorado consumers saved over $9 million because of the existence of that statewide standard. We expect that this standard would result in an investment of over $8 billion of new investments in this region. I believe that much of that certainly would be in Minnesota. Not only would manufacturing facilities be located here, we're going to be hearing from a couple of our members, the Wind Energy Association members, two different companies from this state who actually comprise 80% of the installations in the entire nation. They travel around the country, obviously, and they have an 80% market share, so it's pretty impressive. And the other issue that we talked about is green pricing, and I just want to capitalize on a contrast between a standard and green pricing. Green pricing is a mechanism that allows me, and I say me because I get 100% of my electricity in my office and my home from wind power through the XL Wind Source program. It's important to me, so I make that choice on my own. But I also know that I'm paying a healthy premium to them for two reasons. One, it covers the administration and marketing costs of that program, and I recognize that, but I'm willing to pay it. In addition, they are buying wind energy piecemeal in small quantities that cost them more. That's why I'm paying a premium. That's why anybody that does a green pricing program pays a premium. That would not be necessary in a situation where all utilities are, whether the utility is buying bulk power. So the bottom line is that wind energy can be competitive with, a new wind plant can be competitive with electricity from any other new power plant. And in addition to the economic benefits of wind energy, I think probably the most overriding reason that perhaps is getting much of our attention these days is in fact that the standard would reduce in the result in the reduction of carbon dioxide by 25% in the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Dunlop. One question that I have, we hear from a number of sources that in a situation in which we have an aggressive standard, given that other states are doing the same thing to some degree at least, that we should anticipate a shortage of turbines and other components, and that would make it difficult to comply with the standard. Could you comment on that?
Chairman Hilty, I need to have you repeat the question because yes, they will require components. Are you saying that will those be manufactured here?
The question is, Mr. Dunlop, simply one of the ability of the industry to supply the demand that would be created by a standard here and in other states.
Part of the reason that foreign companies, have not chosen in large part to locate their manufacturing facilities in this country is because of that erratic market. And by establishing a stable market, it does invite them to establish U.S.-based manufacturing facilities. Of course, we also have a manufacturer who just began turbine manufacture last year called Clipper. That's a U.S.-based firm that just started up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Yes, indeed, the industry will ramp up to meet the demand that will grow from these sorts of measures in this state and around the country. In spite of the fact that some of the equipment that's imported into the state to meet our current demand has come from overseas, that also provides economic activity in this state. All you have to do is look at the Port of Duluth website, and you'll see that the equipment that was imported to the Port of Duluth and shipped to southern Minnesota and over to North Dakota, and they're very happy with the fact that they are importing wind turbine components. It's a trade-off for them because there's a growing demand for the Siemens machine, the Siemens turbine that were imported to the Port of Duluth, and Siemens recently announced that they will be establishing a U.S.-based blade manufacturing plant just to the south of us in Iowa.
Other questions? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty, and to the testifier. My question goes back to the wind integration study, and I'm sure you're probably aware of it, and I just want to point out to those that are in the audience what that integration study found, and that is at a renewable energy standard of 15%, the rate increases annually would be $3.80. Now, this doesn't take into effect or take into account putting up the turbine, and there's some other costs that weren't included, but at a rate of 25% for renewable energy standard, we're looking at a rate increase of approximately $13 at the high end, and that's per year. And you are citing the studies or the examples of, for example, it's Colorado, where there was a cost savings of over $9 million in the acquisition of the resources that they need to put up these turbines. I'm wondering, to correlate with the wind integration study, to really get a good idea of the cost to the ratepayer, I need to have all of the costs included. And right now it looks as though it's promising to put a renewable energy standard in place that it's not going to have a great impact upon our ratepayers. Can you provide us with the documents or the studies or the resources that you've talked about as far as the cost savings to other states or other regions? And I also look to our European friends. I was over in France in November, and of course in some of our European countries, in the European countries, there are a number of wind turbines that have been put up. And I think that we probably have some good data out there that could be shared with this committee as we contemplate enacting a renewable energy standard, and I'm just asking if you could provide us with those documents.
Mr. Chairman.
No.
Representative Volpe, indeed, I most certainly will provide those documents to you. We need to make clear, though, what that study that was performed under the direction of this body last year really included. That included the incremental cost, as estimated, to integrate wind energy into the utility system. That's not the cost of electricity. It's not even the direct impact on the individual homeowner's bills. Because, as I used to say, the cost of delivered energy does include that cost, and it is projected to be less than electricity from other new conventional power plants, regardless of fuel source.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dunlop, thanks a lot for bringing this information forward today. I appreciate that. And I see in your first statement here in your release that wind power capacity increased by 27% in 06, and it is expected to increase an additional 26% in 07. And then going back to the back page here, it says, as I read it, in 2006, then the top five states were Texas, Washington, California, New York, and Minnesota, and Minnesota is 150 megawatt. Does that include, Mr. Dunlop, the current installation going on now, or what do you see happening this next year? I know there's a 200 megawatt farm going up in my home county, and is any of that included in the 06, or was that going to be, what do you estimate Minnesota's number to be in 07?
Mr. Dunlop.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, I can provide that information to you more accurately, but I think it's in the range of about 350 megawatts will be added in 07, and that is a function of, frankly, federal policy. The production tax credit was slated to end at the end of 07, and shortly before Christmas, that was extended by 1 year through 08. It really does provide a much different situation for our members than the situation where the tax credit was allowed to expire, but rather it was actually extended a full 12 months before it was due to expire. That has given two things. It has shifted some of the projects that were scheduled to be completed in 06 actually to 07, and actually some projects from 07 to 08. So it has some market impact. But we will be seeing, as it says, we're expecting another 26% increase in the total installed capacity of wind energy in this country by the end of 07.
So, Mr. Chairman, so with Minnesota, 150 megawatts last year, and if I'm hearing you right, you're looking at 350 megawatts this year. That's a pretty good jump, but that put us into number two or three here in the national level race. How's it in the national electricity race here, or wind race?
Chairman Healthy, Representative
Mr. Dunlop.
I believe it's a good possibility. However, I think that you also see the number there that in the state of Washington, that they added 428 this past year. Well, Washington already had about 300, so they're getting very close to us now, quite frankly. And I'm not even sure. We may pass Iowa, but perhaps Washington's on our left flank.
In
our final point, Agnes, we'll do our best to satisfy your competitive spirit.
Thanks. I'm all for this. I love this stuff. In the graph in the bottom, you know, as I see this, we're really fluctuating here. We're going from 1696 down to 410, back up to 1687, down to 489, back up to 2500. Mr. Dunlop, we're really a lot of jumping around here in this. Is there one thing you can cite to do this? Is it federal rules like the production tax incentive credit you talked about? Or why aren't we seeing more of a stable growth in this instead of these extreme fluctuations as you see?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, indeed that is true. It's a direct consequence of what I consider to be the only thing intermittent about wind energy is our federal energy policy. The output from wind energy systems varies over time. Federal policy is intermittent. It stops abruptly. And consequently, the pattern has been that businesses like the ones we're going to hear from had to pay overtime. They had to pay a premium to get the people out in the field to finish a project and to bring it online by the end of the year. What we're seeing now in 06, 07, and 08, because of the action taken by the federal government, is that it looks like that's going to be 3 years of robust growth. And I think that's further evidence of the value of long-term energy policy. The extension that moved the deadline or the termination of the federal production tax credit from the end of 2005 to the end of 2007 was passed in 2004. That created that stable market that resulted in steady markets for in 06 and 07. So the evidence is clear, and I think by passing a state renewable energy standard, you augment that long-term market development that our businesses need.
Thanks. Members, I, as I said at the beginning of the meeting, I do want to make sure that everyone is heard and every question is addressed, but I would ask that we be mindful of time. We have approximately 20 minutes left in the hearing. We have a couple of testifiers who have come from out of the city to testify. We have two more members on the list with questions for this testifier. I would ask that you keep them as brief as possible, and if it's at all possible, could we address them at a later time? I see Mr. Dunlop has escaped at any rate. Maybe we can get him back to address those questions, or possibly they can be addressed to other representatives of the industry. I believe we have Mr. Fredrickson.
Yes.
If you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Doug Fredrickson. I work for a company named D.H. Latner & Sons. We're a Minnesota company from Avon, Minnesota, up by St. Cloud. This happens to be our 100th year, so I take the opportunity to mention that this is our 100th family-owned private business. We are, in fact, a service provider to the wind industry. To give you an idea of what service we provide, the owners come to us with a map with docks on it. These are where the wind turbines need to be to generate the best wind. How much will it cost, and when can you get it done? And putting the roads, putting the substation collection system, the foundations, the erections, all that stuff, and give us a price, give us a schedule. And that's the service we do. And actually, our roots come from yourself right here. Our company, a segment of our company's work, along with another competitor who's here today from Mortenson, we both got our birth from the Minnesota wind industry when the Prairie Island issues were determined, and the wind industry basically came to life in Minnesota. We had the opportunity to work in those early projects. Those early projects allowed us to take that knowledge into the growing wind industry across the nation, and I think it has served Minnesota well, and we're hoping to, and as we have, we've brought it back to Minnesota as well, and we hope to in the future as well. What I'm going to testify about today is what our company witnesses ourselves in the building of these projects across the country. And so my testimony will be basically around that. I will be throwing in one financial number, two financial numbers. It is my own, but I think our experiences are pretty vast. By the December of this year, Blattner had installed 4,500 megawatts ourselves in the wind industry, three-quarters of what the state of Minnesota is contemplating between now and 2020. In this house file. And I say that again to offer you guys, you ask me any questions you want. I have experience to cover what we've witnessed. There's lots of areas you've been talking about that I'll stay away from on the political ends and some of the business ends that belong to our customers. The bill that's being looked at, or the file is being looked at today, and it does have some significant advantages, we believe, over the past ones, and here's why I say that, is that the requirement that we've witnessed in states that we've worked in have allowed some other things to occur that help reduce the peaks and valleys and actually broaden the people who can participate in the wind industry across the country, and I'll explain why. To get to the dollar values, the number of turbines or number of megawatts you're looking at here, it will easily exceed $7 billion of outside private investment capital coming in. Granted, the utilities here, as in other parts of the country, can elect to buy these facilities up front and invest their own money, but it's not a requirement. The industry to date has been primarily private money coming out, making these investments. The $7 billion could easily come from outside the state, in the state. But it wouldn't have to, but those are choices, economic choices, I'm sure that are financially sound ones that the in-state utilities could make on their own, and they'd be the best judge of that. Of that $7 billion, $2 billion of that work is going to be construction-type services. Those that would be outside the cost of the turbines. $2 billion worth of work that has to be done inside the state by Minnesotans, Minnesota products and gravels and cements, and rebar and nature of that. I'm just trying to give you some sort of a financial impact. To move on to what we witness, as we work around the country, our crews are actually ones that are on the farmer or the landowner's property, and we get to meet with the landowners. You guys have who've had projects within your districts have probably heard of the benefits and had the benefits, and we get to meet with the county commissioner and the mayor and the head of the school district, and who talk about, man, you wouldn't believe how much money this makes to us, you know, the property taxes and such, bringing those in, and it's really a fun part of our work. But even one or two turbines makes a huge difference to these landowners, and we had the pleasure of being on the back of the pickup tailgate listening to all these stories and stuff like this, and you guys don't have that opportunity, but I'm here to tell you that it's a huge difference to these individuals, this $3,000, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a year difference that they get every year. So, what I'd want to also indicate is that an extended renewable like this, I think, broadens the participants in this way, is that our customers, primarily our customers, they are the big ones. They are the ones that own the big farms. But we're here to testify or to indicate to you that a longer one would allow more of the smaller, I believe, it's my opinion, that it would allow more of the community-based farms to compete. When there's a 100 RFP or an RFP for 100 megawatts come out there and it has to be satisfied within just so many days, there's only a few players who can step up to that kind of a project that quickly and answer that call. The smaller guys, they don't know what's coming. They don't know for sure if it's going to be somebody to buy this wind farm down the road, because it comes in peaks, really big peaks, as you were just talking about, really low valleys. And they don't have the staying power to hold this project together. So a longer-term thing allows more of the smaller players. They know it's coming. They have from now till 2020. To get their stuff together and find the sources, find the money, get organized, stuff like this. I believe it'll be a real big benefit to them, from what I've seen. And we talked to a lot of potential people, of course, who want to build wind farms. So we've met the smaller groups, and we certainly have met the larger groups. So one last item I want to indicate is that I think the industry was fortunate. The legislature authorized it. Minnesota Department of Commerce to do a wind study revision on the maps, and all of the hub heights and the wind speeds at these higher hub heights, I think, are a huge underrated boon for rural Minnesota. At the time, it was back in 97 when we did our first work in 97 on Buffalo Ridge. Buffalo Ridge was considered the only place that you can do commercial wind in Minnesota. And it's this little narrow band, and it's all going to come from there. It all has to be run through transmission lines. and only a few counties are really going to benefit from that. If you look at the wind study maps, you'll see that instead of this narrow ridge now at 50-meter hub heights, which the early projects were, at 70 meters now, all of southern Minnesota is now commercial, the southern third. You go to 100-meter hub heights, and the third of the whole western third of Minnesota now becomes potentially commercially viable. That technology to get to those higher hub heights is just around the corner. It'll certainly be here well before 2020. So the longer term, Minnesota's regime, wind regime, the technology that's coming, the distribution, the smaller groups, I really believe that there's a lot of things that are coming that will allow a lot of projects to be integrated into Minnesota on a very good basis based on our experiences. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kalin, Representative Smith, sorry we didn't get to you on the last testifier. Can you adjust your question to Mr. Fredrickson? If there are no questions, then we will move to our next testifier. Thank you very much, Mr. Fredrickson. Our next testifiers, I should say, Charlie Olson and Jerry Fowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Fallis, and I'm with the Blue Green Alliance Coalition of Unions and Environmental Groups, and most recently, the Alliance between the United Steelworkers and Sierra Club. We're currently hosting town hall meetings across the state of Minnesota, educating and informing our members about the cause and effect of global warming and some of the solutions to global warming. And one of the solutions that we're focusing on right now is renewable energy, not only for the environmental benefits, but also for the jobs it can create. We feel that the first step is to pass an aggressive renewable energy policy standard. We have to prove to the rest of the country that we are serious about attracting investors and the jobs associated with renewable energy. With 25% by 2020 standard, we believe it will create a guaranteed market for renewable energy manufacturing. I've seen firsthand what can happen to a community when the industry that they depend on goes bankrupt. I worked for LTD Steel Mining Company for 30 years, and I represented employees that worked there. When they closed down in 2001, there were over 1,400 people on the street looking for jobs, and there just weren't any jobs available on the Iron Range at that time. It was a lot like the early 80s when there were massive layups across the Iron Range, and there was an exodus from the Iron Range down to the cities because there just weren't jobs. You had 55-year-old guys, head of households, competing with teenagers in supermarkets for carry-out jobs and stocking shelves. Minnesota, especially the Iron Range, we can't depend on one major industry for jobs. We have to diversify, and renewable energy will allow us to do that. Renewable energy projects generally create more jobs per dollar investment do investments in fossil fuel-based energy. You know, there are a lot of examples of jobs created by renewable energy, and you've heard about a lot of them here today already. I'm sure the jobs you heard about are all good-paying jobs. Denmark generates 20% of its electricity from wind resources, employs over 20,000 people. Germany employs over 40,000 people in its wind industry. And wind turbine and tower manufacturing is the second largest consumer of steel in the country, next to automobiles. And we've already talked about Gamesa in the United States. I don't know if the reason they didn't establish a plant here is because of a renewable energy standard, but the fact is they did settle in Pennsylvania, and they do have a renewable energy standard. Right now they employ over 1,000 steel workers, and steel workers are now in the process of negotiating contracts for good-paying jobs and health benefits. The renewable energy standard, Texas has 2,500 employees in the wind industry, and they also have a renewable energy standard. In California, more than $31 million a year are paid in wages and paid to employees in wind industry. Wind industry pays almost $7 million in property taxes. I was recently reading an article about the LM Glass Fiber Blade Company in North Dakota. They opened they produced windmill blades, and they opened in 1999 with 60 employees. By the end of this year, they hope to have over 720 employees. There's that much of a demand for it. You know, the list goes on. There's many, many jobs associated with it. Renewable Energy Standard will help protect our environment, create jobs, and help Minnesota become more energy independent. That's why we're supporting this 25x20 Renewable Energy Standard. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Mr. Olson, did you have anything to add?
No.
Members, are there questions for these witnesses? Very well. Thank you for your testimony. We have next on the list Mr. Brent Berglund from M.A. Mortensen Company. I think that will probably be as far as we're able to get with today's hearing. I apologize to the other witnesses who were prepared for today, and I hope that we'll be able to have you back on Monday. Mr. Hinkle, I'm sorry about that, but I want to give you as much time as you need.
Mr. Berman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present my testimony. I'm Brent Berglund. I'm Director of Business Development for M.A. Mortensen Company. I will keep my comments very brief. For those who don't know who Mortensen are, we're a Minnesota-based, privately held construction company. We're 52 years old, and we're in our third family generation of ownership. We're based in Minneapolis, and we have offices throughout the United States. We generate over $1 billion per year in annual average revenues for the company in all parts of our business. According to the Engineering News Record, we're the 35th largest contractor in the U.S. Locally, we've been involved in the construction of projects such as the Xcel Energy Center, Target Center, Minneapolis Convention Center, Walker Arts Center, and numerous hotels and hospitals. We entered the wind energy business about 12 years ago, and we currently have operations in the United States and Canada. We've completed 41 projects in 14 states, totaling over 2,400 megawatts and 1,900 wind turbines. In Minnesota, we've completed 9 projects, totaling about 317 megawatts, which is about 35% of the Minnesota generating capacity. We're one of the largest wind power contractors that John Dunlop and Doug had referred to earlier. We've got about 35% market share. By the end of next year, or end of this year, we will have installed about 5,000 megawatts of wind power. Presently, we're constructing 2 wind farms in Minnesota, with Minnesota's largest wind farm, the Fenton Project, where we currently employ about 100 craft employees and estimate to provide approximately $15 to $20 million in local economic area impact, which is probably about a 50-mile radius from that project site. Currently, we have 170 full-time team members involved in the management of wind projects. 98 of these team members are full-time Minnesota residents, which represents about $10 million worth of annual economic impact to Minnesota. Combining 2006 and 2007, we'll have employed about 150 craft workers on the 2 Minnesota projects with a total labor value of about $12.7 million. We'll have approximately 65 Minnesota residents, primarily from the Iron Range in northern Minnesota, working on projects in Minnesota and around the country, with a total labor cost of approximately $5.6 million. Projects we have under construction provide opportunities to 26 Minnesota companies who provide engineering, construction, and services to our projects. In addition to the very well-documented environmental benefits, wind power represents a very tangible, positive economic impact to the residents and businesses of the state of Minnesota. Fluctuations in short-term renewals of federal programs do not provide the consistent long-term economic benefits for Minnesota residents and companies. Therefore, we need to establish stronger renewable energy standards to make greater and more consistent use of our renewable energy resources. We strongly support the House File 4 and support the 25% by 2020 renewable energy standard. Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just an additional comment to Mr. Berglund. Working on the project down there, Are you going to get that done by the end of the year?
Absolutely.
And Mr. Chairman, I only can testify to your company, the Mortenson Company, but that big project down there, I never heard one complaint from you folks who came in and did a great job. I appreciate that and appreciate you doing it right as a company.
Thank you.
Mr. Berglund, is it fair to comment?
Well, members, we have the prospect before us of actually ending the committee hearing on time for once, so I think we'll do that. We have a number of people that are interested in continuing testimony on this bill, and we will continue with testimony on the bill on Monday, and hopefully we can get to amendments on Wednesday. So, no further business. The meeting is adjourned.